This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Is it just me, or has TV gotten really complicated? I'm either endlessly searching for my favorite shows or subscribing to a dozen different streaming services to make sure I can watch everything I love. And I'm not even saving that much money compared to my old cable bill. Thankfully, Philo has changed all that for me. One service, all the stuff I need. Philo's got current seasons of the shows I can't miss live on networks like Paramount, A&E, MTV, Discovery, and TLC. Classics like The Office, Martin, and Friends that I never get sick of, and all of the incredible originals on AMC Plus, from Mad Men to Orphan Black. Don't forget their library of more than 75,000 movies and shows, all of which I can save and rewatch anytime for a whole year. Never miss a minute of shows like Gypsy Rose, Life After Lockup on Lifetime, Yellowstone, or Fatal Attraction. Best of all, with Philo, you get all this for just $28 a month. No contracts, no hassles. Just one subscription and a world of entertainment. So go to philo.tv and check it out for a free 7-day trial. That's philo.tv to start watching.
All right, Dent, what do you got?
All right, second time's the charm. We got a little bit of news this morning. Aziz Alshaier, the guy that hit Trevor Lawrence, has been suspended for 3 games for the hit. I don't know if the altercation after also factored into the suspension, but this is the first time that he's had an instance like this.
Yeah. First of all, can we just talk about the hit for a moment?
Sure.
What do you think? How dirty of a hit do you think it was?
I mean, it was definitely a dirty hit. Everyone's saying he should have slid before. I think that's silly. You knew he was sliding, and you still decided to go forearm to the head. I've always found that interesting. You know, I don't play defense, so maybe I don't understand the speed of the game. But when you can tell when a quarterback is sliding. So to still dive headfirst at them and hit him forearm to the head, it's a dirty play. I don't know if it's a 3-game suspension worthy dirty play, but it's definitely a dirty play. It's also, by the way, why I love the fact that Jaden does not slide. You're opening yourself up to get head.
This is what I wanted to talk about. That we've talked about this before, you know, earlier in the season when Jaden did the, you know, kind of fall forward. He can slide. I this has been pointed out before. First of all, I actually think the hit, it's not egregiously late, all right? He also does not go in helmet first. You know, this was not a helmet to helmet. This was forearm and arms up around the neck and the head area. There's no doubt about that. And I'm not saying that this isn't a flaggable hit and that it's not, you know, on some level, you know, he's not trying to pull up necessarily. But I've watched this hit a bunch of times. There's no real helmet to helmet. That's not the attempt. He's not going in there leading with his helmet. But he does have a bit of a history, and then, you know, his reaction to it, which they did. I'm looking for, hold on, I had this a second ago. John Runyon is the NFL VP of, I guess, you know, these kinds of punishments. Here's what he said. He said, the league deemed the hit unacceptable. Or here's the full statement. For those that don't know, let me just make sure everybody does know. In the Jacksonville-Houston game on Sunday, Trevor Lawrence scrambled, went into a slide, and Aziz Alshaier hit him late, went forearm and arms into the neck and head area, head went back, knocked out, went into the fencing position, that, you know, position that says the brain just suffered. you know, a concussion, and he was concussed. He was out. He did get up and was taken off the field. And as you know, Shaiir was penalized and ejected from that game. So the punishment gets handed down. He gets 3 games, and Runyon, who is, here's the title, VP of Policy and Rules Administration, he wrote, "You're involved in a play that the NFL considers unacceptable and a serious violation of the playing rules. Video shows you striking the head neck area of Jags quarterback Trevor Lawrence after he clearly goes down in a feet first slide. You led with your forearm and helmet and delivered," he didn't really lead with his helmet, "delivered a forceful blow to the head neck area of your opponent when you had time and space to avoid such contact." I do think he had time and space to avoid it. And then he said, Runyon wrote, "Your lack of sportsmanship and respect for the game of football and all those who play, coach, and enjoy watching it is troubling and does not reflect the core values of the NFL. Your continued disregard for NFL playing rules puts the health and safety of both you and your opponents in jeopardy and will not be tolerated." He, after the blow, ended up getting into, you know, kind of a mini brawl with the Jag players. And, you know, Runyon wrote, "You removed your helmet and re-engaged with your opponent while walking down and across the field, which started another physical confrontation near the end zone." I'll tell you what, man, it is hard to play these positions. There's been enough time of watching these plays. These defenders know what to do. But as far as the slide first, to me, that is the most vulnerable position. You know, that is the spot in which you will get injured, because a lot of DBs are not going to be able to pull up in time. They're going to be, you know, they see a big dude and he goes into, you know, a lot of these quarterbacks go into these slides a little bit late and you end up with hit. It always gets flagged, even if it's unfairly flagged because the quarterback didn't go into a slide late. I don't think that was the case here necessarily, but the sliding is more vulnerable to your head than is, you know, kind of going in shoulder and getting the head down to the ground as somebody comes in to hit you. It just seems like it's the most exposed part in that slide is your head. We've seen it happen a lot now. I don't know. The league has to do what it's got to do, and this guy's got a history of late hits and flagrants, so you've got to punish a guy that, you know, you have to take history into consideration there. But we've seen worse hits. It's just the reaction to it, too, man. When you get the player going into that very scary fencing position, it is so much more memorable.
But then the taking the helmet off and wanting to fight. I mean, he wanted to fight Brandon Scherff. He's a big dude.
Yeah.
But in the side of the
city. Brandon's still in Jacksonville, huh?
He is, yeah. He seems to be doing well. Seems
good
to be doing
for
well. But it is like the reason that I mentioned that, and I'm glad you wanted to talk about that as well. That's why I'm glad that Jaden is not sliding all of the time. Like, yes, sometimes he falls kind of awkwardly, but the as you mentioned, there's really no defense for your head and neck when you slide that way.
Yeah. I think somebody pointed that out. Remember when we were talking about it early in the season? And I forget who it was, but somebody in the league, a former player, said it's actually the most vulnerable and defenseless position for a quarterback. And if they don't go down early enough, and look, sometimes you don't want to go down super early because you are marked down once you begin that slide. And if it's 3rd and 6 and you can get to the marker and then go into your slide, so you try to get a little bit more and then it gets a little bit dicier in terms of the timing and somebody coming up to hit. And here's what you can't get. This is where, like, the Mahomes stuff where he'll kind of play on the sidelines as he's trying to bait somebody into hitting him late. You know, he'll fake like he's about to go down or go out of bounds and then he'll turn it upfield. You can't have much sympathy for those plays if they end up getting hit the next time after they've kind of, you know, faked a going down or faked going out of bounds. The quarterbacks really can play with the incredible you know, cushion that they've been given in terms of protection to get more yardage. I have said for years, this is hardly a big reveal, that the hardest position right now in the sport to play is DB, specifically safety, but just DB in general, because you are asked to give up, to risk giving up a big play, a positive play for the other team, a negative play for your team, versus committing a penalty. That's a terrible choice. You know, especially when you talk about defenseless receivers. Well, I guess I have to let him catch it then. Because if I come in and try to break it up and the ball's high or the ball's up near his helmet, then we're risking 15 yards. So it's two bad choices. It's let him catch it and tackle him, which is a big play for the offense, or go in and risk being flagged for a 15-yard penalty to make a big play. It is a tough position to play. By the way, expensive too, because I would bet you that no position gets fined more than safety in the NFL. I don't know, maybe pass rushers do. On hits on quarterbacks?
I would say safeties are linebackers. I feel like nobody gets penalized nowadays outside of a situation like this for like a roughing the passer anymore. I feel like it's always those over-the-middle shots that get penalized.
They've gotten much better with roughing the passer. They were so hell-bent on any sort of close call flagging, and I think we've seen that. That was one of the emphasis. That was one of the postseason off-season points, right? They were going to be a little less liberal on flagging roughing the passer.
Thank God.
But it's either pass rushers or safeties that get fined the most, is my guess. It's certainly defensive players.
It's definitely defensive players. Yeah, without question.
All right, what else?
It might be time for you to finally put the nail in the coffin for the 49ers. Both Christian McCaffrey and Jordan Mason headed to IR. McCaffrey had a lower body injury, and then Mason, who'd done a really good job filling in for him, he went down as well. The snow thing was fun, but they were slipping and sliding all over the field on Sunday night.
Yeah, I didn't even know that Jordan Mason. I watched that whole game. It was just kind of peaceful to watch that game. And by the way, the snow just kept getting harder and harder, and by the time you got to the fourth quarter, if you didn't stay up and watch it, like, it was, you could barely see. Oh, I wanted to point something out. Remember I said during the Pittsburgh-Cleveland game, I hate when the networks and Amazon did it that night, when they transpose the yard lines and the hashes and everything else onto the field so that viewers who are watching can tell where the ball is, right? And I don't like that. I'm fine with not knowing in a really good snow game. So the other night, NBC transposed everything, and then it got worse and worse. And they did something that I thought I could be wrong. They either completely pulled the overlay transposing of yard lines, hashes, etc., or they just took out the hashes. And if they did that, it looked much better. It's the hashes that are clear. Like, why do we need to see the hashes as a viewer? That's not important. What's important is the yard lines, 20, 30, 40, and those lines themselves as to where they are, goal line, that's important. The hashes aren't really important. And they started transposing hashes, and then I noticed in the second half they weren't doing it. I'm wondering if they finally realized that it's just a bit much, and it just doesn't look like it's the game. By the way, not to mention, when a player runs through that on your TV, runs through the area that's been transposed, they part of their body that's going through it disappears briefly. It's an odd way to watch it.
I'm glad they fixed it, but also, like, as far as the hash marks go, as long as you can see the 10, the 20, I feel like as a viewer, if you watch the NFL, you know where the hash marks are.
Exactly.
Like your eyes are kind of accustomed to the field. And in the NFL, it's not like in college where there are certain stadiums where the camera is positioned differently, which I can't stand. But there are certain stadiums where
In a lot of college games. A
lot of college games.
Yeah.
But that's not the case in NFL stadiums. They're all designed to be proportionate for television.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any stadium that has a different kind of looking angle anymore. I think you're right. I think they basically have gone to a uniform camera position or camera positions for every single stadium. But to what we were talking about, 99.9% of fans watching a game, the hash marks are insignificant. They're not sitting there going, oh, look at where they are formationally because they're lined up on the right hash going left to right. Like NFL fans, the very, very super sophisticated, I mean, almost coaches watching, understand the significance of, you know, in certain play down distance, what they're going to be running based on where the ball's, you know, positioned, right or left hash. And as we both know, the hashes are much different in the NFL than they are in college football. But I don't think that they need to be, you don't need to see them. You know, you need to see where the yard lines were. But I didn't realize Jordan Mason got hurt, getting back to your original discussion. McCaffrey went down. Like, he knew he got hurt, and he literally went down for, like, a 3-yard loss. That's the last carry of the year for him, I would assume. But I never saw Jordan Mason get hurt. I'll tell you this, man. The 49ers, they actually were running the football, and they got into the red zone multiple times in the game, like 3 or 4 times at least. And they just, you know, Juszczyk fumbled as he was about to cross the goal line, in one of those. That's been their biggest issue all year. They've moved the football even with their injuries, but I think they are at the bottom of the league or close to the bottom of the league in red zone offense. Purdy was not very comfortable in the elements at all. Not even a little bit.
This has been a great year for your take of last year about maybe not trusting Brock Purdy. When he doesn't have all the bells and whistles, he's average at best.
This is going to be a big offseason question, you know, whether or not to pay him or not.
I mean, that might go back to our earlier topic of conversation, hour number one, about potential openings. They liked Sam Darnold last year. Maybe there's a return there.
Darnold would be good to return. If the Penix situation, Kirk for a year with still a lot of that talent out there, might be Kyle's answer. That's a possibility. This happens to teams, and I know that the window is starting to close a little bit on the Niners because of contracts and having to pay people, and kind of all started really with the Brandon Ayuk saga in the offseason, and then he gets hurt. Trent's been hurt. McCaffrey's been hurt. Debo's been hurt. Everybody's been hurt on that team. And so you can chalk that up. Teams have years like that, and they are, you know, these aren't excuses. They are reasons. Health is number one in the determination of who ends up having good seasons versus poor seasons. If you lose the most man games due to injury, you're not going to the playoffs. You're not going to the deep into the playoffs anyway. I think the year that the Packers won it over the Steelers, they had a significant number of injuries along their offensive line, but that was really the only spot, and people questioned as to whether or not they could make a run, and they did. But the evidence far more supports that injuries are right at the top of the list of determining good seasons versus bad seasons. If you stay perfectly healthy, you got a much better chance to be on the right side of 10-7 versus 7-10, because that's kind of what 25 to 27 teams are each year. Stay healthy, we're 10-7. Get injured, we're going to be 7-10. And the 49ers are in the 7-10 year right now. I don't know if that means the end of a run here, but, you know, the talk all along was they better get it done before they have to decide on Purdy and paying him. And they got to decide that in this upcoming offseason. So, what else?
All right. Tomorrow there is a show debuting on Amazon. It's Pop Culture Jeopardy. You're thinking, all right, why do we care about this at all? Well, Kevin, I didn't tell you this. I applied to be on Pop Culture Jeopardy. So I'm inviting you and all of our listeners to hate watch Pop Culture Jeopardy with me tomorrow. I'm very upset. I think I actually would have excelled on that show, and I did not get a call back, so I'm not too happy about it.
Well, did you do the online Jeopardy quiz?
I did. No, I did the full process of applying for it, and it was teams of three. It was me and two other people, and they didn't tell
me. Oh, I don't know how it works. I mean, I'm a big Jeopardy fan in general, but I'm not familiar. I would just think it's all pop culture questions.
It was.
But you just mentioned teams. How does that work?
Well, so it's you do it in teams of three, so they would just take normal people and put them all in teams of three. I believe that's
so it's like it's academic
To an extent.
You don't know what it's academic is?
I don't know what it's academic is now.
It's academic, I think, is the longest running television show on television in our market. It's hosted by Hillary, I'm forgetting your last name. She's great at it. She's been on TV, Channel 5, radio, WTOP, and she's been hosting It's Academic for years. What?
Does she do a pop culture version of It's Academic?
No, but they're teams of three. I was just making the comparison to you have, you know, this is the high school thing. You're not familiar with It's Academic?
No.
By the way, my high school, Walt Whitman in Bethesda, I think has won It's Academic more than any other high school in the DMV. I would bet that that's true.
I was not nearly smart enough for that in high school.
I wasn't on the show. School. But it's always been a fun show to watch, and it's been on the air, I bet you, since like the 60s, because look it up. See if there's a Wikipedia page on It's Academic. And I need to know what Hillary's last name is because I'm blanking, and she's lovely. She's really good at what she does.
It's been, 1961. That was a little before
1961.
Yeah. I'm trying to find Hillary's name on here.
I got the page up now.
Is the name.
What is it? Hillary Howard. Yeah. She's great. She's phenomenal at hosting. And the guy that hosted it for years, Mac McGarry, I think was his name. He hosted it for like ever. And I guess I don't want to kill him off here if he's still living. But I'm assuming that he passed away, and that's why he hasn't been doing it for years and Hillary has. I'm on the page now. Yes, Mac McGarry passed away in 2013 at the age of 87 years old. And he hosted the show from the beginning, which was October 7th, 1961. And it is recognized by the Guinness World Record Book as the longest running quiz program in TV history. Mac McGarry hosted it from 1961 until 2011, and then Hillary Howard took over from there.
Well, if they do a pop culture version, they should give me a call so I can live my dream. Instead, I'll be hate-watching Jeopardy tomorrow.
Let's see how many times Whitman's won it. Do they have a list? Oh, they got the champions list. Oh, yeah, Whitman's on here a bunch.
Whitman is on here about them and Bethesda Chevy Chase dominated in the 70s and 80s. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
That's a dynasty right there.
Yeah, we were really good in It's Academic. Not so good in some other sports, although we weren't terrible. All right. So real quickly, so it's teams of three, and so you and two friends applied?
Yeah, we applied. There was an online test. It was like a screening test. I think it was 20 questions. It might have been 40 questions, but they didn't give you the results. It was kind of like, all right, thanks for sending this. If we need you, we will give you a call. And none of us got
it. Do you think you did well on it?
I actually did think I did pretty well. Now, I'm sure, like, there were some stuff that I was way over my head. I'm not the biggest theater guy in the world, so there were some theater questions and some music questions, you know, before 2004. Little hazy, you know, in 2001, I was six. Wasn't exactly paying attention to Britney Spears at the time, you know, so I was.
What were the categories? Was it just TV, movies?
You said theater. There were some like newer stuff, like TikTok and social media stuff that were in there as well. So it spanned about 20 years, which I thought was a pretty good time frame. But there was just some stuff that was a little out of my wheelhouse because I was so young.
Hmm. So is that going to be on like Jeopardy's in this market on 7:30, Channel 7.
So this is going to be on Amazon Prime. I believe it's just they drop three episodes.
Ken Jennings going to host it?
No, Colin Jost is going to host it. I would have loved to meet Colin Jost.
The Saturday Night Live guy?
I think Michael Che is funnier, but I would have loved to meet Colin Jost all the same. Maybe meet Scarlett Johansson in the process.
Why Scarlett Johansson?
Colin Jost is married to Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There you go. That's it. By the way, that would have been a pop culture question that I would have gotten wrong.
That would have. I would have gotten that one right. I love Scarlett Johansson.
I do too. I just didn't know who she was married to. That movie that she did with Bill Murray, why am I blanking on the name of it? Where they're in Japan, in Tokyo.
Groundhog Day, right?
No, not Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day.
Love that movie. I'm blanking on it. But anyway, all right. Anything else for news?
One final thing I want to touch on, the Hoyas. Big win last night. They're 7-1. They beat UNBC.
I know, but they play West Virginia coming up next. West Virginia beat Gonzaga last week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. WVU looks like they have a good team, but who do they play a week after WVU? They got Syracuse. A little bit of the old Big East.
Is Syracuse any good this year? Maryland plays them. Right. I think within a few days of Georgetown playing them.
Syracuse right now on the season is 4-2. They're not bad. Nobody's in the ACC has played conference schedule stuff yet, so you don't know how they match up. But they're 4-2 to start the year.
Thank you, all of you. Lost in Translation. Appreciate that. Yes, that movie was very good.
That's a pop culture question I would not have gotten right.
Well, I couldn't pull the movie name. I just knew they were in it together, and it was really good. All right. We're going to do, like we do on Tuesdays, and this will be the final one. Well, not the final one, but the final regular season college football recap. The rankings come out tonight, and man, did things get interesting on Saturday. The Michigan-Ohio State game we'll talk about, but we also have to talk about this Georgia-Georgia Tech game that went to 8 overtimes with this stupid 2-point conversion thing. We will do that when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.
Blinds.com Cyber Monday sales event is happening now. Get some of the best deals of the season with up to 50% off site-wide, plus a free professional measure. Avoid the home renovation overwhelm. Swapping out old blinds for custom window coverings delivers big results, and Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Skip the long lines or waiting around at home all day just to get a quote. With Blinds.com, shopping online doesn't mean sacrificing quality, style, or service. A Blinds.com design expert can help you make the perfect selection. We can even handle everything from measure to install. Get your whole home installed for one low cost. With over 25 million windows covered, Blinds.com is the number one online retailer of custom window coverings. Shop Blinds.com Cyber Monday sales event today for some of the best deals of the season. Save up to 50% site-wide, plus premium doorbusters and a free professional measure. Up to 50% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
It's better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you. And also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Pick up your book bags. Grab your notebooks. It's time to go on campus with Denton.
Hey, give me my theme music.
All right, big boy.
Man, what a weekend.
What a Saturday.
I mean, what a
What
weekend.
A Friday night. I mean, the Georgia Tech-Georgia game, which I want you to save until last so we can talk about the college football overtime. But where do you want to start?
Well, college football overtime, great show. Everyone should listen to it on SiriusXM.
It's an excellent show. The host, I heard, is pretty good.
Yeah, he's pretty good. So we're going to start with the biggest upset. The biggest upset to me was Michigan and Ohio State. Now, the Syracuse-Miami thing was big as well, and I think those implications are actually heavier. But watching Michigan, this year's team, beat Ohio State, this year's team, which was supposedly the most talented they'd ever have, just ask Urban Meyer and Jim Tressel, pretty big names in Columbus, Ohio. They put a lot of pressure on Ryan Day, and they completely collapsed under pressure. I mean, I cannot remember a more pitiful game, a more sorry excuse of an offensive performance than what we saw from Ohio State. Only 10 points against your rival at home. And then you get the flag planting stuff. But really, the loss for Ryan Day, this will not fire him. But if they have an early exit in the college football playoff, because they will still get in, he's going to be in a lot of trouble.
If he loses in a first round game, let's just say against Tennessee, something like that, at home, let's just say they're an 8 seed when we get to the playoff field and they play a game in the shoe against Tennessee and lose at home, he's getting fired.
Yeah.
I think he has to get to the national championship game at a minimum. And it's not – he's 47-1 against the rest of the Big Ten. This guy can obviously coach. He's lost four straight to Michigan, and everybody understands this. When you are the head coach at Michigan or you're the head coach at Ohio State, there is one game that is the most important game to win. It sounds insane, but you have to beat the team up north if you're the Ohio State coach, or you've got to beat, you know, Ohio State, the Buckeyes, if you're a Michigan coach. And it just hasn't happened for him. The last three, they were not the better team. You know, Michigan won three straight with Harbaugh. Remember, he hadn't gotten over that hump. And then once he finally did, he wins three, and then this year was supposed to be the beginning of turning it around. They went off as a 23-point favorite in this game.
Mm-hmm.
23.
They didn't even score half of that.
The game itself, let me just say that I don't think you and I gave Michigan enough credit for playing much better football sort of coming in. We remember the painful games, you know, early in the season against Texas, you know, where they couldn't, you know, throw the football. They actually had a big lead, remember, had a lead at Washington and lost. But their problem was at quarterback more than anything else. They were still pretty tough in the trenches and on defense. They crushed a Northwestern team that had not really been, you know, handled in the way that Michigan handled them the week before the Ohio State game. They were right there with a chance to beat Indiana in a game on the road. But nobody thought Michigan would win this game. Nobody did. This was going to be 3-year frustration coming to an end. Let's start with the kicker who missed two chip shot field goals. Talk about choking, okay? Because their kicker, I think, had been pretty good all year long. And he missed two shorties in the biggest game of the year. And then you talk about Will Howard. I thought Will Howard had been good for a lot of the games this year. You know, you and I think have been on opposite sides of Will Howard. I thought he was much better than Kyle McCord and was an improvement, even though McCord played very well at Syracuse this year. But he had horrible yips, horrible nerves, and just made some of the worst throws that you could imagine. Two picks and at least one or two others that could have been picked. And then Michigan, you know, they can't throw the football either, but they're totally intent on saying, we're going to line up, we're going to go slobber knocker, we're going to run it at you, and we think we can make 10 yards in 3 or 4 plays. crazy game. It was such a poorly played game. And at the same time as it was building towards this possibility of Ohio State losing this game in Columbus, it became really compelling.
I love rivalry games that are lower scoring. I think it's way more impactful than if this was like a 40-35 shootout. While those games are fun, there's something about this one where it was like, is one play going to define this? And the one play was that Will Howard interception, not in the red zone, but the one that put Michigan in the red zone for their only touchdown because they only had to go 2 yards.
How about the interception Warren threw into the end zone? That when they were second and goal, I was like, you got to be kidding me.
I mean, both quarterbacks. Michigan's had three quarterbacks this year, and somehow none of them have been good.
I'll tell you what, after watching them early in the year when against Texas, I think going 7-5 and beating your chief rival as a 23-point dog as in this defending championship season, this was a successful season for Michigan if you saw them early.
Definitely. They're also the reason that Indiana didn't fall from the rankings when they lost to Ohio State. I have always felt like the committee this year values Michigan way higher than we as viewers do because outside of the quarterback, they're good everywhere else. It's just they can't throw.
So, two things out of this game. One, you agree with me that Ryan Day has to at least get to the national championship game, which, by the way, means winning three playoff games to get to the title game.
Yes.
And that if he doesn't, he gets fired?
Maybe not. I think he needs to at least win one or two games. He has to show that he can, like, if he loses, let's just say hypothetically, I don't know that this will match up, but I guess we'll find out a little bit more tonight. If they go up against like a Notre Dame, who historically does not have a good reputation at all in the college football playoff or big national games. Championship, if they lose to them, he's done immediately. Now, if they win one or two games and then lose to, like, Georgia or to, like, Oregon again, they square off against them.
What if they lose to Tennessee at home?
Then he's gone. If he loses at home to anybody again, he's gone.
Yeah,
I don't think they'll get a home game. I think they'll be on the away side. But if he loses to anybody at home, he's gone.
I mean, I saw Heather Dinich this morning. I was watching her. She had Ohio State and her in the rankings that we'll see tonight projected to have a home game as an 8 seed. Like an 8-9 game.
An 8-9 matchup. It'll
be close. I mean, and after that, you'd play the 1 seed, which could potentially be Oregon, and a rematch with Oregon. God, would Oregon want that?
No.
You know what?
No.
I mean, why would you want Ohio State in that second round as the 1 seed? That seems almost unfair. So that was one, you know, thing that we have to talk about. Fine. What about Michigan and the flag planting episode? Your take on this is what?
Loved it. I love that sort of stuff. And I felt so weird listening to Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt. You know, Klatt's been involved in a lot of rivalry games when he was at Colorado. It sounded like they were calling the Kennedy assassination. They had never seen something as disrespectful as that. I loved it. This is what rivalries are supposed to be about. This is the one sport in America where you have like legitimate hatred towards one another. You know, the NFL, that's dissipated substantially. The NBA, that's dissipated substantially. Every professional sport, you lack real legit rivalries, but you still have that in college. If you don't want somebody to plant their flag into your turf, beat them. Because the loser never is going to do it. Ohio State showed more fight with a piece of fabric being placed into turf than they did for 60 minutes against their biggest rival. I loved that Michigan did it, and I thought it was incredibly telling that Ryan Day just kind of sat there with a 1,000-yard stare while all of that happened.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I love the rivalry thing that's legitimate and genuine, and you feel it in that game. Like, these are two fan bases that hate each other. These are coaching staffs that don't like each other. These are players, some of whom, you know, were friendly in high school and played together in high school or played against each other in high school, and they immediately adapt. You know, this is one of those rivalries where, you know, it's not just a fan thing. It's just not a media thing. It is a player thing, and it's hard to get that in sports, especially in professional sports. I love that about that. But let me just say this. If you're going to plant a flag on, you know, at midfield as the road team after beating your arch rival, I have no problem at all with the Ohio State players responding the way they did. Now, that adds to what you said, which is, you know, as I was watching it, and I was watching it live, and maybe many of you were, and I know Denton was, before his big college football show on Sirius XM, but I absolutely loved the intensity of what was going on, because it really did reflect something that is totally authentic and genuine, the whole, you know, whatever word you want to say. This is a legit hate-filled rivalry. If Ohio State's players hadn't responded, I would have looked down on that. That would have been, you know, to me, them responding on their home turf to that is not poor sportsmanship or loser activity. I don't think, honestly, that if I were the coach of a team, that I would advocate or allow, after one time, planting a flag on an opposing field. I would, just for the purposes of this, for the purposes of not creating a furor and a frothing of mouths prior to the next game we play against them next year, I would have celebrated with my team, with my fan base, and gotten into that locker room and just absolutely gone wild and celebrated all the way back to Ann Arbor. It's not that I wasn't entertained watching it as it was going on, but if Ohio State didn't answer in that particular situation, to me that would have been really soft and would have been a bad look for them.
If the Buckeyes didn't respond to that, that is where the eye test comes in. I would kick them out of the playoff.
I mean, well, I don't know about that happen, but certainly you know, I think about the rivalries that I've been involved in as a fan. The three NFC East rivals, the Cowboys being number one. And for me, the Maryland Duke thing was a big, big deal for a long period of time. If they started, you know, tramping around and trampling on the floor and doing some sort of celebration at midcourt and then took a Duke flag and planted it right there, I would have expected Gary Williams' bunch to go nuts. By the way, they would have never done that in College Park because they wouldn't have made it out of there alive. I mean, I don't know about keeping them out of the playoff, but I had no. If you're going to do that, you do it at your own risk.
And there were four examples of that. And Steve Sarkisian actually stopped Texas from doing it against A&M, which kudos to him. I was upset, but kudos to him. But Florida and Florida State got into it because Florida State is atrocious. North Carolina and NC State got into it. Didn't realize that rivalry was still as big as it was. I guess it maybe got bigger. And then Arizona State and Arizona. Arizona got beat by 40, but they still got pissed off when they put the spear, the devil spear, into midfield. This is what Rivalry Weekend is about. It's not just colors and logos facing off against each other. It's legitimate hatred between programs. It's beautiful.
It was intense, man. But it certainly became kind of a trend. Real quickly on Texas A&M, because I'm sure you were going to go to it. I don't think I've ever seen a crowd that lit before kickoff.
Yeah.
Electric.
I mean, A&M and Kyle Field has been great this year because they've had couple instances of that.
I think that fan base is a bit strange, but
they're a cult.
It is very cultish. But the scene in College Station before the kickoff, what was it, 110?
110 is what their stadium seats, yeah.
That was incredible. That was a road team that went in there, and I give them all the credit in the world, although, you know, A&M had opportunities, but man, Texas was good defensively. Where did you want to go next?
I do want to talk briefly about Miami. We'll get to the overtime thing maybe after the break because we're short on time here.
Yep.
But Miami's out. They lost to Syracuse. They have zero quality wins on their schedule at all, and losing that game, not being a part of the ACC championship game, it's now going to be SMU and Clemson, who Clemson lost this weekend as well. But Miami is out as far as I'm concerned. There's no reason for them to be in the college football playoff. They had opportunities. They blew opportunities. And it was poetic that Kyle McCord, just hours after Ohio State lost to Michigan because they could not score, happened to be the guy that came back from 21-0 to win and lead Syracuse to a victory.
Yeah, I mean, I thought for sure Miami was out with that loss. But I've seen a lot of these projected rankings for tonight, and they're in. I'm with you. They lost. Look, Georgia Tech turned out to be a pretty good football team this year. Syracuse, you know, was they were a massive underdog at home Sunday, even though, you know, they've had some decent results this year. Remember, they beat Georgia Tech early in the year after Georgia Tech beat Florida State, and we thought that was a big deal. But I don't know how they make it either, but why are people projecting them to be in?
It's because they have two losses, and then you'd be comparing them against teams in the SEC with three. But I could argue that all three of those teams in the SEC with three losses, Bama, Ole Miss, and South Carolina, A&M's not a part of that group. But the other three, I would take them over Miami, all three.
Would you take South Carolina over Miami?
I would take South Carolina. I might argue South Carolina over Bama. I know they lost to them early in the season, but I don't know that anybody's playing better than South Carolina right now.
No, they're not. I think it's, let me just say, if Clemson beats SMU, I hope they don't. I really want SMU to win the ACC in their first year and go to the playoff. Clemson's not a good football team. And this is where, you know, the ACC is essentially, they've got one really good team, as it turns out, SMU. They're going to play a team in Clemson who just lost to South Carolina, lost earlier in the year to Louisville. That if they win on, they're going to be in the playoff because it's an automatic as one of the, you know, top four conferences. Doesn't mean automatic seeding or bye, but they're not a good football team. I was so happy South Carolina won that game. Sellers is something else, man. That quarterback, he can really run.
He's so fun.
You think he's an NFL quarterback?
Low level backup.
He's young, right? Is he a redshirt freshman?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he's that young.
Okay.
He is a redshirt freshman. Maybe he isn't.
He is, right?
Wow, I remember him playing a lot more last year.
He's a big dude.
He's a really big dude. He has some accuracy things that he needs to work on,
but he's as good of a runner as Milroe is.
Yes, I would agree with that. And a slightly better thrower than Milroe. I mean, that throw against Alabama is going to haunt him. He should have made that throw for the two-point conversion.
Yeah. What else?
I think we should take a break and get to the overtime stuff.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to hold off on the overtime thing. But when we come back, I do want to talk about, you know, sportsmanship, flag planting, even though this wasn't a flag planting situation. But I do want to talk briefly about what James Franklin and Penn State did to Maryland at the end of their game. If you didn't hear about it, Mike Loxley was not very happy, but I will share the details with you when we come back. So Maryland finished up a very disappointing 2024 season, losing at Penn State on Saturday afternoon. After Michigan had beaten Ohio State, Penn State just needed to beat Maryland to make the Big Ten title game, which they are in, on Saturday night against Oregon. Penn State was a big favorite, went off as like a 24-25 point favorite over the Terps, who have struggled all year long. They were 4-7 coming in. After three really good Mike Loxley years, this was a step back. They had lost their starting quarterback, Lua Tagovailoa, who had been the starting quarterback and a big part of why they had three really solid years in a row. The best years they've had since Ralph Regan was the coach in 2021, 2022, and 2023. This year, step back year. Got a big recruiting class coming in. I don't need to bore you with Maryland football talk. As we do know, Maryland is a basketball first school, for those that hadn't heard. Anyway, on Saturday at Penn State throttled Maryland. And they picked off a pass with a minute to go in the game up 38-7 and returned it down to like the Maryland 15-yard line. And at that point, it's like, okay, you know, they're going to take a couple of knees. Maybe they run some plays. And they ran it twice and lost 2 yards. And then with the clock ticking down 8:76, they dropped the quarterback back and he threw an incomplete pass. And the clock stopped with 4 seconds to go. And on fourth down and 12 at the Maryland 15-yard line with 4 seconds to go up 38-7, they dropped the quarterback back against a three-man pressure, 8 in coverage, and still threw a touchdown pass into the end zone. Loxley didn't like it. He had some words for James Franklin at midfield. He said it was BS. And this is what James Franklin said when he was asked about it after the game.
It didn't look like it was the smoothest post-game handshake. Is that the statistics and their ones still in there, or can you explain that last touch?
Threes and fours in the game. But when the threes and fours get to go in the game, they get to play football. Those guys deserve to play football. Your ones are in the game. You were trying to score. We're trying to score. On top of that, you're playing cover zero. If you don't want, play cover two. So I'm good with it. And on top of that, there's also a change in college football. We are trying to play as long as we can, make the playoffs, and be seeded as high as possible. And scoring as many points and a point differential matters. All that matters. And if you don't get that, it's really not my problem. So, W, 1-0, I'm good with it. Anybody that's not, that's their problem.
So, real quickly, almost everything he said, I'm fine with. You know, that's always a challenge. You know, a coach puts in a blowout, puts in the twos and threes. You can't tell them not to play football. You know, you can call the game differently to kind of avoid running it up. But you don't have to do that. You know, Maryland was trying to score. And during the, you know, portions of the fourth quarter where you put those subs in against Maryland's ones, absolutely, they should be playing football. The issue really is, per usual, the truth will do, and he didn't speak the truth. The style points at this point, there was not going to be a difference in the way they were evaluated, 38-7 or 44-7. Okay, they're already in the Big Ten title game. They're going to have a chance to advance as a top seed or a top two seed with a win over Oregon. They're in no matter what happens. They were in as long as they beat Maryland on Saturday. But the final play of the game is the part that I think, if you're going to take exception to it, I think Loxley might be taking exception to it. A, they were not in cover zero. Okay, that's just a flat-out lie. Maryland rushed three, dropped eight in coverage. All right, so he's trying to make a point by saying they're blitzing everybody. No, they didn't. It was 4th and 12 with 4 seconds to go. They had run the ball on 1st and 2nd down. Keep running plays if you want, but run the football. Dropping back and trying to throw a touchdown pass is rubbing it in. That's what he was trying to do. Be honest and say, playing our twos and threes, want them to play football, that's great. You know, but at the very end, you know, we thought we wanted to, you know, kind of make sure they understood how much better we are and we're in recruiting battles with this team, etc. But that was a rub it in play. 4th and 12, 4 seconds, three-man pressure, and he throws it into the end zone for a touchdown. I have no problem with the rest of it, though. You know, you can't put your twos and threes, your backups into games and tell them not to try hard or not give them opportunities to run the kind of plays they've been running in practice and how hard they've been working in practice. I totally agree with that. The final play was rubbing it in, period. Ben Volen, NFL senior writer for the Boston Globe, next.